With due respect to those from the Indian subcontinent who are here, and with thanks to the person who put this in my hands a week or two ago, I'm going to start with a poem, The Blind Men and the Elephant. Some of you may know it. It was six men of Indostan, to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against its broad and sturdy side, at once began to brawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me 'tis mighty clear, this of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt around the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "E'en the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can, this marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope, than seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each of his own opinion exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. And the moral: so oft in theologic wars the disputants, I ween, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate about an elephant not one of them has seen. Now then, one can treat that poem rather as the six men were treating the elephant, and come up with a whole lot of different ways of interpreting that poem. It tells us that any perceptions we may each have about a subject are all equally valid or equally invalid. It tells us that any individual's grasp of truth is limited and partial, so none of us is in a position to hold any view with certainty. Or we might learn from it that it's better to share knowledge with others and build up a wider picture than be content just with your own perception and perhaps misconception. Or you might want to say with, I think it was Alexander Pope, "A little knowledge is a dangerous thing." Those six men of Indostan were labouring under two main handicaps. The most obvious one, they were blind, so they had to rely on other senses to build up their picture of reality. And the second handicap isn't quite so obvious. You have to stop and think about it a bit. It's more a mental rather than a physical handicap, a limitation in the mind rather than in the body. They lacked a mental category which could make sense of what they were experiencing, a bit like using the word car or currency to someone who's never come across a car or currency before. It's not quite true to say they hadn't got a mental category for elephant. They had the word elephant. They keep talking about the elephant is this, that, and the other. But it didn't mean anything to them. If you think of the human mind as a sort of a mental filing cabinet, an Aktenschrank, then when they went to the file in the folder marked elephant, there was nothing in it. They'd not come across it before. It was outside their frame of reference. It was a label without content. And that's why they had to try to fill up that file from the categories that they did have. You might think there were little bits of paper in that file saying, "bit like a wall, bit like a snake, got something of the spear to it. You see, they were trying to fit this elephant into their own sphere of reference, their frame of reference. They were trying to make sense of something new and unfamiliar by thinking in terms of what was old and well-known and familiar. So they had that physical handicap of not being able to see, but being able to see wouldn't on its own have actually solved their problem. It would have helped, but it would only have been a step. Because even with sight, they needed some content to flesh out what that label, elephant, meant. A mental handicap then, they couldn't quite grasp it. And that poet encourages us to see that as a sort of parable, a likeness, for our own understanding of God. That's what he was saying in the last verse. So oft in theologic wars, the disputants, I ween, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate means sort of prattle, waffle on, schwafeln, about an elephant not one of them has seen. In other words, he seems to be saying, when we talk about God, we're no better off than those six men. We're limited by a physical handicap. Not that we're literally blind, but that God is not visible to the human eye. So sight is a sense which doesn't help us very much in that respect. And we're limited by a similar mental handicap. It is hard for us to get hold of the concept God. He's too other. He's too much beyond us to fit in any category that we have handy. Most people seem to have a file marked God in their filing cabinet. It seems to be part of being human, that we have that label somewhere in our minds. But for many, it's not a file we look at or even think about very often. And when we go to that part of our mind and take out the file and open it up, it's like those six men. It's a nice label, but not a lot else. Nice tune, too. Thank you, Jens. Das haben wir schon bemerkt. Danke, Jens. Thank you very much for letting me have the floor again. That's very kind. So if there is anything in our file marked God, very often what we have in that file is a few jottings and a few doodles, a bit like a nice grandfather, a bit like that rather difficult headmistress I had at school, or whatever it might be. The poet has a point, you see. When we talk about God, we're likely to be railing on in utter ignorance. We're prattling on about a concept not one of us has seen. At best, we're feeling our way towards a definition of God that is personal and individual to us, partial and limited, therefore, and almost certainly idiosyncratic and a long way from reality. If we're honest, when it comes to the God question, we're in the dark if we're left to our own devices. It's a bit like the famous definition of a philosopher, some of you may have heard, as a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that isn't there. But just imagine someone turned up one day who knew where the light switch was. And suddenly that dark room is full of light. What if someone had turned up on the day those six men were investigating their elephant and had waved a magic wand and their eyes were suddenly opened? That would go at least some way to dealing with the first handicap, being unable to see. And you know, that's really, in a nutshell, what the Christmas message is all about. In fact, it's at the heart of the Christian message, Überhaupt, as a whole. God has switched on the light. He's appeared on earth in a form we can see and hear and touch and feel. And that's what the Apostle John is telling us in that first, in that verse which we've printed out on the sheet for you. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The very first reading we had told us at the beginning who that Word is. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So when the Word became flesh, God clothed himself in human flesh and appeared amongst us. We'll sing later. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. The Word became flesh. What better form could God take on to make himself known to us than that of a fellow human being? It's a form we understand from the inside out. It's a brilliant solution to that physical handicap that we can't normally see God. But what about that other handicap, the mental one, the category God being either empty or full of speculation or with a few thoughts borrowed from other files somewhere? What can be done to fill out that category with reality rather than guesswork? Well, this same verse goes on to point us towards an answer to that too. It's not immediately obvious, perhaps, to the first-time reader, but when it says, he made his dwelling, Wohnung, amongst us, he's actually referring us to knowledge that's already out there in the public domain. It's telling us that there is a place we can go to flesh out our God file, and we need to go to the people of Israel. The Greek there could be translated another way, which might give a hint to some of us. It might have echoes. The literal translation would be, not he made his dwelling amongst us, but he pitched his tent amongst us. He tabernacled amongst us. Er hat unter uns gezeltet. And those with good memories and good Bible knowledge of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, may remember there was a time when the people of Israel were a nomadic people. They spent 40 years on a journey from slavery in Egypt to freedom in the Promised Land. And for most of that journey, they took with them a special tent called the tabernacle, the Stiftshütte. And the main thing about that tent was not that any of them would sleep in it. It was where the Lord God Almighty would dwell, where he would meet with his people, where he would be ansprechbar, if you like. Because their God had a history and an intention of dwelling amongst his people. He had said to them many years before, I will put my dwelling place among you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you will be my people. But how did they know that God really had taken up residence in that tent? It's a nice thought, God dwelling amongst his people. But how did they know it was anything more than a figment of their imagination? Well, the answer was that when it happened the first time that they erected the tent and God appeared, they knew it because, we're told, a cloud of glory, Herrlichkeit, descended. We're not told more than that. But it clearly was awesome and unmistakable to them. Much the same happened later when they settled permanently in the Promised Land and built the temple. And God's glory filled the temple, we're told. And you might ask, what is meant by his glory? And that's a good question. I often wonder how best to get hold of that idea. How do we pin down that idea exactly? For me, the most useful way to think of it is that it's the very essence of God. You might say it's the godness of God. Look again at that verse on the sheet with that in mind. What happened when God made his dwelling amongst us? We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father. John was convinced that in looking at Jesus, they had seen the very godness of God. You couldn't get a fuller picture of God than that while still in this life. And what happened 2,000 years ago in Palestine wasn't out of the blue. It wasn't a sudden change of tack. It wasn't God deciding on plan B. It was God building on what he had done before, dwelling amongst his people as he always had done, making himself in some sense visible to them. And what did the godness of God look like for those witnesses in the first century? We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, full of grace and truth. And again, those are words which come cascading down the generations in the experience of God's people. Again and again, the people of Israel had experienced their God to be full of grace, gnada, loving kindness, never failing love, poured out not on the lovely or on the responsive or on the deserving, but on those who were so often the very opposite. So it's a concept that includes mercy, forgiveness, patience, long-suffering. It's part of what the glory, the godness of God, looks like. And again, the people of Israel had experienced their God to be full of truth, absolutely, radically committed to justice and righteousness, absolutely, rigorously opposed to injustice and unrighteousness, the ne plus ultra of integrity and trustworthiness. And they'd often learned the hard way by being on the wrong side of his desire for righteousness and justice. He came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John is telling us that these same qualities, which were manifestations of God's glory down the ages through the Hebrew scriptures, had now shone forth in a human life, in the Word become flesh. What God is doing in Jesus Christ is all of a piece with what he has been doing from the dawn of time. He is making himself known to humankind. He is revealing his glory. He is showing us what he is like. He is filling up that file marked God in the mental filing cabinet. But he's now doing it in a way which far surpasses anything he has done before. His dwelling place is not a tent, but a person. His dwelling place is no longer a temple of stone, but a man of flesh and blood. The limitations are lifted. The handicaps are overcome. The excuses, the Ausreden, are no longer valid. There's no need for blindness or ignorance anymore. It's hard to think what more God could have done to make himself known to us. So test it out. Read one of the Gospels. We put some individual Gospels on the table at the back. Read the John's Gospel, the German versions there, Johannes Evangelium. They tell us what it was like to meet with and spend time with God himself. You've ever thought it would be great to do that? Well, we can't fully do that in this life because Jesus, when he came to earth, was limited to one place and one time. But we can begin to draw close to that as we read the story of the Word become flesh and as the Holy Spirit opens our minds to understand. The offer has been made. The opportunity is open to get to know God. There is one other limitation or handicap, though, which we don't share with those men of Hindustan. It's a self-inflicted one, which is mentioned here. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. The handicap or the limitation is that so often our attitude to God is not can't, but won't. Not I cannot get to know God and understand God, but so often I will not. I won't recognize him. I won't receive him. It would be too inconvenient. And the contrast couldn't be clearer than the way John continues. To all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. That is actually the greatest divide in history. Those who do and those who don't recognize and receive Jesus Christ as the Word become flesh, as the Savior of the world. And Christmas is a time just to reflect on that and think about that. If you're not sure which side of that divide you are, take one of the booklets or read a gospel. Think about it. If you are someone who has received, and as John puts it here, been born again of God, well, enjoy that afresh. Let the truth of the Word made flesh sink in afresh into your mind, your being, your soul, your whole approach to life. And rejoice that we're not prattling on about an elephant that none of us has seen. We're not discussing in ignorance a vague idea of God. We talk about a God who has made himself known, the Word made flesh. And that age-old, evergreen invitation by God, we're going to hear more about in the reading, which is about to happen.
The open invitation. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk, without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me, and eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me. Hear me, that your soul may live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love promised to David. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the evil man his thoughts. Let him turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for the eater. So is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it.